All right. All right, everybody. Welcome to Dang's show. Thanks, Alan. So everything's broken and nothing's working right, but that's all right. We'll get it figured out. Actually, we may not get it figured out. But it's all right even if we don't get it figured out, because one way or the other, I can make music play while I make a phone call or leave the room. So, whatever. It'll be fine. It'll be fine. Now, all the things that were supposed to happen, yeah, they didn't happen. So, yeah, maybe you heard a little bit of Day Before Yesterday's intro bumper music, yeah? I don't know. Anyway, so today's show is going to be a disaster, but it's also going to be really good. There may not be any timed breaks. I'll definitely stop and mention my sponsors when I can. Is this damn thing still updating? Hang on. I can't believe how long it takes to install a video driver these days. I want to kick that computer right in the face. Well, you know, I just don't have the skills to operate computers for a living. And yet somehow I got that job. All right, well, whatever. One thing good about me, foreign policy. Yeah, I'm really good on foreign policy. So I suck at doing radio, and boy, do I suck at the technical aspects of the audio and the stupid Windows end of everything. And no, I can't get different pieces of equipment to talk to each other to save my life. If my friends didn't do my work while they were at their jobs, nothing would happen around here. Thank God for that remote access stuff. Some smart person invented that. All right, well, anyway, Mark Thornton's going to be here. See, this is how I make up for sucking at radio. I've got an exquisite taste in guests. Oh, yeah, and also, I got a great foreign policy here, so. There you go. Yeah, coming up on the show today, Mark Thornton will be here from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. Well, we're going to make fun of the New York Times a little bit, which I know is low-hanging fruit, but, well, here's the thing. I hope that making fun of the New York Times is a compelling and interesting narrative so that you'll pay attention when Mark Thornton teaches you why to hate central banking. And not just, you know, out of jealousy that whoever these central bankers are must have more money than you or me. No, that's not it. It's that they're stealing. And it's that the way that they're stealing is really hurtful to everybody else in a lot of terrible ways. So anyway, good old Mark Thornton's going to be here to talk about all that. And then also, I will be complaining about things. And boy, do I have a lot to complain about. First of all, 83-year-old nun to be sentenced for sabotage. So here's what she did. She broke into a U.S. storehouse, some anti-terror security, all the rights you've given up, and they don't even have a guard out front of where they keep the weapons-grade uranium. Yeah, busted, caught red-handed. Not the Iranians, the Americans are the ones with all the weapons-grade uranium, you know, for killing people with. And anyway, so this, and they've got no good security there, apparently, because the nun decided she wanted to stroll right in, and then she did stroll right in. And then when she strolled right in, after that, what she did was she took a hammer and banged it on the wall. I don't know if there was even so much as a chip out of the concrete. She's 83 years old. She came in. Maybe did she bang on the nuke itself or on? No, there wasn't a nuclear, it wasn't a silo, it was a storehouse. What did she do? Painted slogans on the outside wall of the uranium processing plant. They spattered blood and hammered on the wall. This nun, you know, servant of God and all that, 83 years old. What did the judge do? U.S. District Judge Emil Thapper has kept her in jail without bail, awaiting trial. That's banned by the Eighth Amendment. You know that? Excessive bail or denial of bail. without just cause, like this guy is a serial killer who's determined to escape and kill again? This is a nun protesting nuclear weapons. Just a small little symbolic act to try to draw your attention to the fact that, yeah, we keep thousands of these things for killing millions of people with. Maybe we ought to, hell, let's think about it at all. Never even mind rethinking it. Let's even just consider the fact that, like, oh yeah, wait, huh, that's right, we do still carry thousands of these nukes, huh? We let our American politicians, the lowest scum of the earth on the earth, hold on to thousands of H-bombs? What? Maybe there's a better way to do things. When your federal court system is locking up 83-year-old nuns for banging a hammer on a wall, trying to get arrested, but then holding her in prison without trial, treating her like some terrible menace to society, enemy of mankind and the state especially. For me, it's just sort of a tell, you know? Like somebody scratches their head every time they know that they're telling a lie, something like that. This is one of the little quirks about American society. Sometimes we throw our nuns in prison for tiny little symbolic acts against the worst machines. Quantifiably, the most terrible devices ever created. I don't know. I mean, honestly, I don't know. I kind of like hippies, but I kind of don't, too. I mean, I can empathize with kind of people just, they get sick of just what sounds like naive, just do-goodery, sort of give peace a chance, everybody get along kind of attitude. You know, I'm a realist. I'm not an optimist. I'm not a rose-colored glasses guy. I don't believe we're ever going to live in a world without violence. But hey guys, do we really need H-bombs? To me, yeah, I think that's a fair discussion. And do we really need to hold 83-year-old nuns in prison without trial while they're, you know, awaiting trial? And she's being threatened. The judge has made it clear he's going to throw the book at her here. There was another judge who was like, you know, signing his elder activist to go and write book reports about national security or whatever. This guy is, he's coming down hard on her by all implications. Sister Rice, according to her lawyer, Sister Rice has said that if the judge lets them go, that's great, but if the judge sentences her to 10 years in prison and she has to die in prison, that's okay also. Is that okay? I mean, I'm not really concerned whether it's okay with her. Under the circumstances, that's the kind of decision that she's making, martyrdom for the greater cause of peace on earth and that kind of thing. But is that okay? That our society allows this government to be our government? That they would go around and treat an 83-year-old nun like that for being a peace protester? And is it utopian to think, really, that you can't have national security without the H-bomb? And think how many nations in the world, more than 175 nations in the world, don't have nukes. Now, maybe you call them protected by America's nuke umbrella or whatever like that, but I would say show me. And that's not what's preventing war between the states of Latin America, for example. And anyway, it's always wrong to use nukes because it's virtually impossible to use a nuke in a war in a way that does not kill innocent people. So, that's it. You know, that's it. There is no argument around that. And if it really came to, for no reason at all except what angels we are, that Russia and China and Europe all combined to go to war against the U.S., the U.S. could still completely destroy all of their capital cities and all of their militaries with conventional weapons. They got lots of bombs to drop. And they got lots of planes to drop them with and missiles to shoot them with. America, the U.S. military, 1/10 of the U.S. military, is more than enough to deter attack from anyone who might ever dream of attacking this country in 150 years. Give me a break. Like, we need thousands of H-bombs. Yeah, well, you want to make sure to hit each target with three. Not because the targets are that hard to hit, but just so that that way each American service gets a chance. Because it's not fair if the Navy gets to blow up everything and the Air Force doesn't get to. That's Noah Schachman's piece in Foreign Policy Today about the Army was getting completely frozen out of the whole nuclear war thing. So they ended up making these backpack bombs that go off at less than kilotons. Just tons. 100 tons. But anyway, as long as it's fission, so they can be in on it too. It's not fair for the Navy and the Air Force to get all the fun. So we got to have 3 or 4 H-bombs for every target in the world. Enough to destroy all civilization, maybe not all of mankind forever, but certainly to destroy all current civilizations to the degree where humanity would basically have to completely start over again concerning the division of labor, the advancement of markets, all over again. And in fact, you know, even as we've talked about with Daniel Ellsberg, even a very limited nuclear war between, say, India and Pakistan, and not even using their entire arsenals, but just a kind of a few nukes here and a few nukes there, that's probably the most likely hotspot for nuclear war on the planet right now. And even that would be enough to completely disrupt the weather cycle on the planet. Put so much ash in the air. It would be enough to threaten harvests, not necessarily every single field on Earth, but to such a degree that the disruption would cost the lives of millions of people. There would be famine. There would be severe famine in places far removed from India and Pakistan, just from all the forest fires and all the everything else, all the fallout. And that's just a limited nuclear war. And now maybe the guys who came up with that are a little bit worst-case scenario for you. I know Gordon Prather doesn't think it'd necessarily be that bad, but be pretty bad. And, of course, innocent people would absolutely be killed. And nowadays, you know, they have the ability, not that they could ever find Saddam Hussein without, or Osama without traipsing all over the damn place for years and years on end or whatever, but still, you could shoot one missile and blow up the Kremlin. And let that be a lesson to you. If they were ever to mess with us, without it being a nuclear weapon, wouldn't have to be a nuclear weapon at all. And anyway, I just, at the risk of just sounding like a religious, you know, an elderly religious pacifist who seem to be the only people who care about this issue, it seems to me like, yeah, we don't need nukes at all. Not really. In fact, Chuck Hagel and George Shultz and Henry Kissinger and all those old establishmentarian guys, they all signed on to that Global Zero thing. And in fact, Robert Surge and Lew's Two Wars Gates, the Office of the Secretary of Defense, some high-level officers put out a report saying we only need 14 nukes. America could guarantee, the U.S. could guarantee its national security and, you know, threaten massive enough retaliation to deter any threat indefinitely with 14 nukes. Instead, we got more like 1,400 deployed right now and another few thousand on the shelf ready to go. Does that sound right to you, to anybody? Throwing out the Eighth Amendment to hold an old nun in prison, an 83-year-old nun in prison for banging a hammer on the wall in an up until now futile attempt to draw our attention. I don't know. It just seems like we could do better than that, you know? Seems like just maybe, doesn't have to be that way. All right, so, I got too much music on here. I need less to choose from. I'm doing a really bad job of hosting the show today, if you hadn't noticed. But it's going to get better. It's going to get real better. So yeah, like I was saying, Mark Thornton's going to be on this show. We're going to be talking economics. Well, I'm going to try to let him talk economics, and so that'll be good. And okay, so now my favorite Motorhead song for a minute, and we're going to talk about sponsors, and then we're going to come back with a little more news and some Mark Thornton and some things like that. It's the Scott Horton Show on Liberty Express. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. I think it's possible to work. Alright, well, I guess we're going to see in a few minutes whether that computer's going to work like it's supposed to or not. It may not. I don't care, yeah. I'm a pirate radio guy, really. So, it's all these hard breaks and commercials and things that screw me up in the first place. I'm kind of happy to have my show back for a minute. Alright, speaking of commercials, this show is brought to you by the Future Freedom Foundation. The Great Future Freedom Foundation. What do we do without them? They're a key part of the libertarian movement. And they're worth your support. So go support them. FFF.org. Now, the Council for the National Interest, basically, they're the anti-Israel lobby in Washington, D.C. AIPAC has their say. The Council for the National Interest has theirs. That's CouncilForTheNationalInterest.org. You might want to consider supporting them as well. Now, Wall Street Window... That's Mike Swanson. He's a former hedge fund manager, and what he does, and I signed up for his thing now. I get all his alerts, and I don't have any money to invest. But I can tell it's a great service. It's certainly a great service. What happens is he just updates all of his subscribers with everything he does in the market. So you can play along or not, just observe, or set up your own account and copy his moves to whatever degree you want or whatever it is, or just, watch for a year and learn or whatever. If you do any or all of those things with what you learn at WallStreetWindow.com, it'll be worth it. No doubt about it. That's WallStreetWindow.com, the great Mike Swanson, and he's also the author of The War State, which sponsors this show as well. And then, I could go down the list, Liberty Stickers, the 10th Amendment Center, etc. I guess I'll talk about more of those later on in the show. Yeah, what time that clock's saying now here? All right. And then I'm going to try to pick a topic here that I can Keep nice and short and sweet. Oh, more on nukes. That's what I can do. More on nukes. Why didn't I correlate this with the 83-year-old nun story in my brain? I don't know. But here it is. It just finally did get correlated live. Right in my brain. McClatchy, D.C. Air Force widens cheating investigation at nuclear facility. And let me see if I can find a paragraph in here where they kind of sum up the last year worth of scandal here, huh? No. Anyway, that's all right. There have been, as everyone knows, one of the commanders, one of the nuclear weapons, Air Force nuclear weapons commanders, general, ended up getting fired because of getting drunk and humiliating his Russian counterparts in Russia and skeezing around with strippers from the bar and whatever like that and getting completely plastered and making a fool out of everybody in front of everybody and all of that. So he got canned, and another one of these guys was gambling with counterfeit chips. Gambling and stealing at the same time. That's against the military law. Out. And then it turned out that all the guys in Montana at the Air Force bases up there, they all cheat on all their tests. About the care and feeding of hydrogen bombs on the tips of three-stage intercontinental ballistic missiles. Pardon me for, you know, getting excited. So, the guys in charge of the ready-to-launch and start a global thermonuclear war-sized H-bombs on three-stage rockets, those guys, bunch of clowns. When they sit in their little classroom and they go through their little PowerPoint presentation, nobody knows or learns nothing, and they don't care. Because when test day comes, they all text the messages to each other. And now, that scandal is expanding. Expanding. It turns out, many more of them were cheating than would otherwise be known. And you know what? This brings up to me the question, another one of the scandals about the Air Force and the nukes was a few years back, might have been 07, huh? 5 years ago now? Is it that long ago? That the Air Force lost some nukes for a little while, and they didn't even know they lost them until they found them again, had flown them across the country when they weren't even supposed to be armed, and they were, and all of this, right? Remember that? But then what happened was there were a lot of conspiracy theories about that. About, oh, yeah, you know, they were going to, you know, nuke Austin, and it was going to be a false flag attack and dirt, because they had to come up with an explanation for how this could be other than the Air Force is run by a bunch of losers. That to be a commander in the Air Force doesn't necessarily imply competence at all, and in fact to work at a government organization. And this is the thing that all libertarians or libertarian leaning anybody ought to be getting by now, is that conspiracy to, you know, injure themselves aside, government always benefits from their failures, whether they deliberately fail, or which they do sometimes, or whether they just happen to fail. No matter what it is, since they've got a monopoly, they just get more money for next time. From, you know, road repairs on to the nuclear weapons. And in fact, I know from talking with Gordon Prather that getting a job running the nuclear weapons or in the entire kind of nuclear weapons part of the military is a dead end for your career. Oh, no. Oh, man, I got reassigned to nuclear this and that. How do I make it back to the rest of the Pentagon out of this dead-end nuclear hallway where only content losers end up? That's the incentive structure in the Pentagon. Well, you know, like Mr. Burns says on The Simpsons, they're a bunch of do-nothing nuclear weapons most of the time. They just sit there. Wouldn't you rather go kill some Iraqis or something? So, in practice, what does that mean? That means that in Montana and in North Dakota, the guys who are actually in charge of the actual H-bombs, meh, they're a bunch of clowns. Never mind what you imagine when you imagine competence. Come on, we're talking about gigantic Air Force bombers full of nuclear bombs. Doesn't that just scream competence, right? Engineering and all that cool stuff. High technology. But instead, Don Knotts is running the damn program. At the end of the day. And I can tell, as you can tell, it didn't work. The music did not play. So here, let me play some Public Enemy for a second. And then we'll be back with Mark Thornton in just a second. Old days right here. By the way, I'm fixing a sign in the chat room. I forgot to, but chat room guys, tell me you can hear this in stereo, right? Tell me it's in stereo at least.
You know what I'm saying? I take you to the back and show you some of my techniques, and I'll stomp a mud hole in your ass, bitch!
Searching my body for fucking what? My guns is for fun and my knife don't cut. How can I make you understand? I get ill on a posse with my goddamn hands. Trouble's not me, I don't mean to cause, but you took one look and began to pause. Didn't holler at the dollar we was willing to spend, but you took one look, wouldn't let our ass in.
We went to fall him over last night, you know what I'm saying? And they're on their way to my crib, man. Now, yo, when you get up on stage and you start talking that garbage, man, yo, me and my crew gone cold, crash the side door, you know what I'm saying? Talking about a nine, yo, a nine ain't gonna stop the bum rush, home.
Yo! Like at first is something. Oh, we realize that the show ain't nothing. For the stunts in the blunts, whole world inside. The reason that the mighty use force applied, no cop will stop all in our way. Gave me status so I don't pay. Might be a trick that you don't like. Coming in the side doors, then I'm grabbing the mic. Walking and talking, fist full in the air. It might seem like that we don't care. A hole for a O, a pow for an owl. Girls start screaming, all I say is wow. That sucker who shot that gun. Whip his monkey ass till it ain't no fun. 5-0 show in, wouldn't you know? They're blaming on the kid, cause all I said was, yo!
Well, I was a little bit late. I guess Mark gave up on me and left. So, great. Now no interview at all. And that was going to, you know, be the saving grace of the salvage of the show, that at least wouldn't be the worst thing ever, because at least Mark Thornton was going to say something on it. But anyway, well, whatever, man. We'll just do something else. What do I care about that? Hey, here, as long as Mark Thornton's not on the show, I'll at least talk about the Mises Institute. Once upon a time, Walter Block wrote a thing for the Mises Institute about privatizing the roads. And I know to all you serious, reasonable people out there, you know better than that because that's stupid and only some stupid person thinks that or something. But actually, no, you're wrong. Actually, what is horrible and evil is government control of the roads. And of course, for the same reason I was saying before the break there, there's no accountability for government ever. The more they fail, the more money we give them. The more they fail, the more power and authority they get over our lives. They've got no cause to succeed. It's just built into the structure of the thing. It doesn't mean every government employee just, you know, wakes up and, you know, murders somebody before breakfast or whatever. But it just means that institutionally, they suck. And in the case of the roads, we lose a September 11th worth of Americans on the roads every month. Every month! You know, here in Texas, they got the digital signs, and they count them up for us. So far, 7,000 dead Texans on the roads this year. Oh, man, it's not even February. Okay, it's not that many. That was last year. But still, thousands and thousands. And yeah, look, some of that is just weather, and some of that is lousy driving, and some of that is just those are the brakes. Some of that is poor automobile design. Some of that is just life. Things happen. Accidents happen. But a lot of that is because there's a merge sign where there should be a yield sign. And there's a yield sign where there should be a merge sign. And there's a blind corner, right, where this street ends and cars coming around this corner going 55 miles an hour, dude. And then you're surprised that people die there all the time. And people begging, please put up a red light here. 17 people have died at this intersection, please. And then, oh, okay. Because we decided that we think it's a good idea for a red light to go here. You can have one now. And then what do? Then they shorten the time on the yellow light to deliberately drive your daughter out into oncoming traffic on the chance that they can make a little bit more revenue from red light tickets. And that sounds like some paranoid crazy thing, except everyone in America has heard of it happening 100 different times. It's all over the place. In jurisdictions in your state, guaranteed, if not where you live. There are yellow lights being shortened. Citizens, including government employees, being driven out into oncoming traffic by the government. So they can make more money off of red light tickets. In Walter Block's piece, he talks about in San Francisco. I believe it's San Francisco, and I'm not from there, and don't a bunch of Northern Californians send me a bunch of tweets, tell me how much you hate me for being so stupid. I'm not exactly 100% certain of this myself, but I'm taking Walter's word for it on this story because it sounds right to me. And what he says is, in San Francisco, it only rains for one little part of the year, and quite a bit then, but only then, and the rest of the year it doesn't really rain. But then when the rains do come, it's the same time every year. And here come the rains, and the rains come. And everybody knows that they've had a whole year for the oil to build up on the roads. A whole year. And everybody knows that just like last year, and just like the year before that, and just like the year before that, there's going to be 175 car crashes on the first day of the rain. When the rain comes and all the oil floats on top of the water, and there's going to be 175 car crashes. Now, if there was any private company in the world that had their customers getting in that many crashes like that in such a predictable way, they would be held liable by the government. I would exploit their shortcoming in order to empower themselves and hold them responsible. At least partially responsible for what happens on the roads. Yeah, this guy was following too closely, and this guy was an idiot and didn't think that, hey, the road is all oily. But, you know, San Francisco is a pretty hilly town, too. You might just slip out even if you're doing good. It could be as slick as ice. Oil can be really slick on the roads. And anyway, so what's the 100% guaranteed solution to this problem? I don't know. Probably spray in some kind of chemical on the roads that helps break up the oil a little bit, do something else with it. so that it's not quite the problem. Maybe we need a whole new innovation to decide what to be done about it. But the government in San Francisco and the rest of the Bay Area, they're never going to do it. They don't care. Why do they care? They're not held responsible. They're not liable. As simple as that. And no, I'm against the government forcing everyone to pay through taxes to build roads and then turn them over to their crony-run corporations. That's not libertarianism. That's conservatism, i.e., e.g., fascism. You know, market economics according to Rick Perry. I'm talking about just completely auction off all of the roads everywhere, or in fact, probably in most cases, just turn them over to the people who own the adjacent property and let them form consortiums and trade their shares and work it out. And no, it wouldn't be paradise, but yes, there would be accountability. And there might be a camera on you, but there's a camera on you now. Only now, the people on the other side of that camera have police power to kill you. In this case, this would just be like a service. You know, yeah, they have a camera on you, but they don't have the right to murder you like a cop does. And anyway, so yeah, and in fact, as long as we're at it, Anthony Gregory's got a great piece, and there's quite a lot of work has been done along these lines, but the one that I really like is Anthony Gregory, and I forget the exact title, but it's at Mises.org, and it's something like Against Police Socialism, which is a good use of that term, right? Because police, oh, right-wingers just love police. But what are police other than from each according to their ability to each according to their security needs? Right? You conservatives are all just a bunch of Marxist communists who think that everyone ought to have to pay for your security service. Well, you should have to pay for your own security on the free market. Just like you want people who are starving to death to have to pay for their own food on the free market. Same principle. They don't own you. They don't have the right to what belongs to you. Well, vice versa. And by the way, if you think that there's a broad consensus in your community that, but we love the sheriff's department because they love us and they treat us real nice. Well, you've just never been to the east side of your own damn town then. Because on the east side of your town, or maybe it's the west side in your town, I don't know. It's usually the east side though, isn't it? In Austin, it's the east side. To them, the police are occupying standing army. They're the enemy. They're a militarized, they're nothing but a roving SWAT team of injustice. The very same cops that you think are just fine. Oh yeah, the local deputy sheriff's very pleasant to me. I saw him down at the 7-Eleven and Well, Anthony says, nuts to that. If the people on the east side don't want to be subject to your standing army that you love so much, why should they have to be? You know, this is why every conservative should be an anarcho-capitalist individualist in one heartbeat, in the space of one argument. Hey, you know how you're always crying that you shouldn't have to pay through your taxes for somebody's abortion that you're morally opposed to? Right. Well, why should anyone have to pay for anything through their taxes that they're opposed to? For moral or any other reasons. Maybe they're just a greedy SOB, but what belongs to them is theirs, and you don't have a right to it, because you're just some other Joe. Everyone is just some other Joe. Or, if you have a divine right as a king, fine, but so does everybody else, so yours doesn't outweigh theirs, if you prefer it that way. If you like divine rights better. If I 100% of my whole life, and I'm not an anti-abortion guy, where that's hardly my issue. I'm an anarchist. Well, I don't want the government to pass a law against anything. I want them to cease to exist. But for people who are hell-bent out of shape about abortion, who say, listen, my most sincere beliefs are against that, and you're making me pay for it, taking the money right out of my check to pay for it, I absolutely sympathize with that. Even if I don't absolutely sympathize with their position or my most sincerely held beliefs are not exactly along those same lines, it doesn't matter whether their beliefs and mine are the same. The point is, why should anyone have the right to hold up a Christian and force him to pay for an abortion he doesn't want to help pay for. Nobody's got the right to do that to a Christian who doesn't want to do that. Ipso facto, end of argument, nobody's got the right to do that to anyone for anything. No socialism for roads, no socialism for cops, no socialism for soldiers, and no socialism for education, healthcare, clothing, or anything else. Everybody belongs to themselves, not to you. Now, if that sounds all cold-hearted and cruel and selfish and mean, if you're a liberal or a conservative, and you think that, oh, yeah, well, I guess Scott Horton must be a born zillionaire who doesn't have to care about anybody else, you got it all wrong. That's actually the Salon.com liberal spin on libertarianism, right? It's anarchy for people who are born rich, white, and male and already have everything and nothing to fear and nothing to worry about. That's not true. In fact, you might have noticed with your eyes and your ears and your understanding of everything that you already know in your life that liberalism and conservatism are the rich white man's anarchy. That's the world we're living in right now. The one with the $4 trillion a year government, with the $1 trillion a year world empire, with the unlimited homeland security police state. You know, the one that the rich white men in the Republican and Democratic parties have made for us. At the behest of their rich white business sponsors. Libertarianism is the everybody's anarchy. The give everybody a chance to live like a rich white guy anarchy. That's what it is. Let somebody whose parents were scumbags grow up with the opportunity to be able to, you know, save money. Get ahead. Regardless of their previous circumstances. Live their own life. And of course, I mean, along the lines of what Bill Gates from Microsoft, which he's hardly a free market libertarian type, but along the lines of what he was saying, I mean, he's a relatively free market type, you know, for a bazillionaire. But along the lines of what he was saying about how very soon there will be no such thing as a developing nation. Very soon there will be no such thing as a poor nation. He didn't say we're going to abolish all poverty from the face of the earth and abolish all war and strife and famine and whatever. But he was saying that, you know, basically markets will be advanced enough to bring food to hungry people everywhere they need it for prices they can afford soon. Like, we are on that path right now. Along those same lines, without any welfare state whatsoever. There's more than enough wealth, and especially if you got the welfare and the warfare and the regulatory state out of the way, not to sell all libertarianism as a whole package deal or nothing, but if you really abolish the state, there'd be that much more wealth for people to share. And no, I don't expect people who spend $200 million on a yacht to give up a lot of money to charity. People like that don't give to charity. They only care about themselves, but I don't care about that. That's fine. Because people who make a couple of hundred thousand a year, they'll give to charity. People who make, you know, less than that and you know, a bit more than that, millionaires will. Billionaires won't. Billionaires don't care about nobody. But anyway, point being, you don't need no welfare state. I mean, look at all the millionaires who leave their fortune to the local university that they graduated from in their will. You know, in scholarships and whatever. Now think, if we didn't have a government raising the prices for all that education in the first place through all their bogus loan programs and all that, but if we had a free market for people arranging for help with their medical expenses at market prices, with their education at market prices, all these things, I'm not saying to be perfect, but at least we would know what real prices were and we could find market solutions toward working out the rest. Instead, everything's a distortion. Everything, every part of every government policy is them breaking your leg and then handing you crutches. And then saying you better be on your knees praying and begging them thankful for being so kind to you. You know? And in fact, I hate making it personal at all because mostly I live kind of on the fringes. I try not to interact with the state very much, and it me as best I can. None of this is really a personal grudge. Really, I'm still just mad about Waco, and that wasn't me. It was just nearby. But anyway, I do have personal experience right now with the Obamacare thing, where my premiums for myself and my wife, my premiums have just gone up by a huge percentage, and my deductible has just doubled. Doubled. Where it's $12,000 a year for the two of us. I mean, it's only $6,000 if it's just her, and I'm relatively healthy, thank goodness, so far, knock on wood. But otherwise, $12,000 deductible now. Oh, but don't worry, you can get on welfare. And then I was reading this thing in Forbes about just, you know, depending on where you are on the income bracket, how much of a subsidy you can get for the cost of your health insurance now. And it's up to, like, people making $80,000, I believe. Was it 60? If you're making up to $60,000, you can get on welfare for the cost of your health insurance. How in the world did America become a place where we would let them do that? Where somebody making $60,000 is dependent on the government. And then the thing is this. I'm sitting here talking with the insurance people trying to work it out. And the only way, and I don't even want the subsidies. I says, I don't want all the subsidies. She says, you know what? Don't worry. You know what you can do? You can write off a lot of the costs on your taxes. So that way, instead of really getting a subsidy, hey, here's a pretty libertarian insurance salesman lady, right? She says, that way, instead of getting welfare, you're just writing it off on your taxes. You're not having to pay as much in taxes. You're not getting as much taken from you, which is nice and is better than going along with the Democrat scheme to make everybody a GD welfare recipient. Oh, but the only way to do that is to be on the plan where your wife has to lose all of her doctors and come up with a whole new plan and a whole new set of doctors and even higher prices. And then at the end of the year, you'll be able to write off on your taxes. Otherwise, if you want to stay on a plan where you get to keep your doctors and you don't want all the subsidies, then, oh no, in fact, if you want to stay on the plan where you get to keep your doctors, you don't get any subsidies at all, not welfare payments or a kickback or deduction from your taxes at the end of the year either. Which, you know what? Fine. I don't know what the hell I'm going to do. I'll probably have to get a second and a third job in order to pay for all this crap. It's completely out of control. You know, I did the math on where no matter what, if I go with the high deductible, the low premium, or the strike that, reverse it around the other way, it's still, no matter what, bare bones, I'm going to be paying $12,000 to $15,000 a year in health insurance. And, you know, costs before my deductibles are up. And maybe more than that. That's just if it's only my wife. If I get sick too, then forget about it. Now we're talking up into the 20s or thousands. Oh, but now I can be on welfare. Oh, wonderful. Oh, thank you so much, Democrats, for being so benevolent and completely bankrupting me and attempting to give me no option but to make myself completely dependent. And, of course, this is why all insurance agencies are perfectly willing to treat their customers completely like dirt, like Blue Cross, and they are deliberately trying to get all their customers to just tell them to go to hell. They are deliberately just hanging up on people when they call in. They're deliberately botching their customer service over there at Blue Cross, Blue Shield, no doubt about it, because they don't care, because guess what? No matter what their losses are, that's right, they get a gigantic taxpayer bailout at the end of the year. Every one of these fascist insurance companies being forced by the government that they own to go through this and force all this fascist Obamacare crap on us, no matter what their losses, the government will make them whole and profitable at the end of the year at all of our expense, no matter what. Unbelievable. Talk about break your legs and then give you crutches and then, you know, demand at gunpoint that you say thanks. You got to be kidding me. And so that's it. I mean, I got to get more jobs. That's it. Simple as that. Because the Democrats have just raised all my prices. and they're telling me that the family doctor I've known my entire life and all the doctors that she's known for, what, 2-3 years now, that all that's got to go. And, of course, I don't want welfare in the first place. Can you imagine they're trying to, they rigged the game now to where people who are making $60,000 a year are supposed to sign up for subsidies for welfare. Like, what are we, all a bunch of Lockheed executives? What are we, Republicans? Collecting off of the public dole? Is there no shame? Is there no sense of what it used to mean to be American? Actually, we don't want free health care. We rather be free to take care of it ourselves. But no. Apparently, we all rather be red. And, of course, I saw a conservative complaining about this. Great point. The same people, liberal women especially, with all their slogans about, oh, abortion is between me and my doctor, which I agree with, by the way. These are the same people who want every doctor to have a government agent between them and their doctor. Geez, I guess it's always going to be the Democrats for the rest of your life, huh? No, it won't ever be a Republican government agent between you and your doctor. The liberals ever think anything through at all, ever. Ever. I mean, not the actual power-grabbing ones, but I mean the ones who believe in them. My God. And yeah, I'm sorry, I hope I didn't get anybody in trouble with, I forgot how much cussing was on that Public Enemy track. Did you know there was cussing on the Public Enemy? I forgot. Well, yeah, I mean, bummer's the show. You know, really what it was is I was realizing he was about to cuss a second and a half before each time he did. Oh, whoops. This is the part where he says, oh, oh no. Oh, well. Anyway. So, coming up. Little top of the hour break. Maybe I'll try again and get Mark Thornton on. Otherwise, I don't know. I kind of already did my economics rant for the day, and I got a ton of foreign policy stuff to cover. So, assuming anyone out there can still stand it at all, is still out there listening, then cool. Hang tight. This is today's version of the news on the Scott Horton Show.
And let them know, whoever's holding the best, just let them go. Cause here's the inside scoop on the fame. They wanna know why I'm seldom seen. Cause who needs the TV screens and magazines? A shooting through the city and fly limousines. Cause one thing I don't like is a spotlight. Cause I already got like, they be like, yo, we had to get together last week. And we know everyone was there except the black sheep. Because my schedule was tight, I gotta write. I'm deep in the archives and keeping them hype. It's been a long time since you heard a strong rhyme. None of these are weak, so when you bite on mine, we can trace the hits and the name that style. MCs will be out of a job for a while. I repossess your identification. So hand in your application. Put your mic on strike until you're unemployed. Contract is up and I'm stamping it void. Your selection ain't this selective, so I'ma put you in your proper perspective. On the dance floor doing a shake, ready to let them break, set them straight. Set them up and pull the plug on them. But instead I let them go on so I can bug on them. Go ahead and flow, cause I close the show. Swing a song for the ladies and rhyme real slow. For instance, once I commence, the crowd is convinced. So now you know who to put your money on. Hurry up before your money's gone. Cause I'm the most common denominator.
straight up rhyme, much greater. I'm like a world almanac, so tell the media, giving them information like a encyclopedia. So bring a dictionary so you can look it up, so you know what I mean when I hook it up. No misconceptions, although I complicate, but this concept will set them straight. They even said that I was locked in jail, so now I guess I'm out on bail. The only island I was on was the strong one, and if I did my bid, I'll be a long one. Cause if I so wait, I'll be upstate in the penile waiting for a break. Cause selling drugs is for handicaps. I got too many skills besides busting rough raps. If I go to jail, it won't be for selling keys, it'll be for murdering MCs. The beat will take over your heart, then I start to cut them in half, cause rhymes are razor sharp. Secure the exits, all MCs remain, cause we got a crowd to entertain. And I know when I go, I'll flow dangerous. Brains a bust, what you trying to explain to us? You got lost and couldn't go on, came up short, so here's one to go on. Elevate off a high IQ, in time you'll find I'm true. Cause once I start on a piece of art, from sun to moon and light to dark, I build the arc. Now you can float off the rhymes I wrote. I'm sure that we'll hit shore without a boat. You can bring a battleship and still get shipwrecked. Attack with a torpedo, what did you expect? Drifting up the creek without a beat or a paddle, cast away on a raft and stand fragile. Rescue your crowd, which ain't a hard job. Me and my knowledge put together, I'm a lifeguard, dealing with actual facts, a solar fact. Here and now, but I go so far back to bring you up to date, so we can elevate. It's no time to wait or anticipate, cause I'm never late. I'm gonna motivate, so I can let them break and set them straight.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, of course, it's a technical disaster on the show today. So let me just real quickly again mention the Future Freedom Foundation at FFF.org, the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.com, wallstreetwindow.com, libertystickers.com, the 10th Amendment Center at 10thamendmentcenter.com, and offnow.org. That's the great project to nullify the National Security Agency through state legislation. And man, you should really go look at their site. They're having great success. They've got bills introduced in all these states and everything. So really, this is a very important mission for people to help to take part in. It's really getting work done there. 10th Amendment Center, offnow.org. And then, The War State, Mike Swanson's book. And then... I guess I can skip everything else for now, at least. Okay, great. So now, our guest today is our friend Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. That's Mises.org. Welcome back to the show, Mark. How are you doing?
Hey, Scott, I'm doing fine. Great to be back on the show. You know, and I think it's the NSA that's going after you and causing all these technical difficulties for you.
Yeah, you know what? If only I was that important. You know what the real problem is? Me. Stupid. Completely, ridiculously stupid. I botched the... You know what it is? The one program is looking for audio in a place where it's not, and it's my fault. Anyway, it's going to take me an hour and a half to fix later, too, but oh well. Here's what's funny. I was reading in the New York Times, and it says in there that Ludwig von Mises abandoned his own stupid theory of the business cycle back in maybe even before the 30s, 29, 1930, something like that, and... At least by the Roosevelt years, anyway. And so, what a bunch of idiots. Murray Rothbard and Hans Senholz and you and Bob Murphy and all the rest of you guys are for still thinking that the... Ron Paul, for thinking that the Misesian business cycle theory means anything when the guy who invented it already abandoned it. So, what do you have to say for yourself, kook?
Well, that's the New York Times, and that's Paul Krugman, and it is totally music to our ears here at the Mises Institute because, you know, first they ignore you, then they laugh at you, then they fight you, then you win. And so we're at the third stage of a four-stage process where ultimately Austrian economics is going to come out on top. and Paul Krugman is going to lose his job, and the New York Times is going right down the toilet. Basically, they're getting desperate, I think. They realize that the economy is not getting any better, that we're mired in the quagmire of caused by the Federal Reserve and the Congress and the president and all the rest. And, you know, basically the idea that Mises gave up the Austrian theory of the business cycle is just wrong. I mean, it's just wrong on a giant scale. Mises correctly predicted the Great Depression, as well as some of his students. And by 1931, they were looking for reasons why the economy was mired in a long depression, okay? Because in a market economy, even if you have the central bank that's screwing up money and interest rates, well, I mean, you're going to have a business cycle. You're going to have a boom and bust. But historically speaking, you know, the boom and the bust was a very quick reaction, and we very quickly cleared out all the bad investments, and the economy got back to a period of economic growth. Now, of course, this didn't happen during the Great Depression. It was one of the few times that it didn't happen. And, you know, and so Mises and others started looking around for alternative explanations for the depth and the length of the Great Depression. And, you know, Mises found that efforts on the part of government to get the economy out of the bust were actually responsible for the economy not being able to heal itself. And so this was a theme that Mises developed. It was a theme that Rothbard in America's Great Depression in 1962 went through in great detail to show that labor markets were being distorted, that product markets were being distorted, that FDR and the American Congress were trying to keep prices high and trying to keep union wages and union jobs in place. And that made it difficult for the economy to recover. Now, in more recent years, economists Richard Vedder and Lowell Galloway have shown that basically the same thing, that real wages in the Great Depression were very high, actually, because prices were falling dramatically and wages were set. And so real wages, the real purchasing power of wages, the expense to business was going up. And then even more recently, a former Federal Reserve official, who Leo Hanian, a big mainstream economist, stumbled across the exact same idea that the Austrians have been promoting for the length of America's Great Depression, which was government intervention into labor and product markets to keep prices high. So Mises never abandoned the Austrian theory of the business cycle. Krugman, as usual, is fast with his figures and with his information. But ultimately, he's a storyteller.
Mm-hmm. All right, now, so if the business cycle theory, I mean, never mind the recovery for a second, but if the business cycle theory hinges upon, yeah, if you're suffering a bust right now, it's because you just had an artificial boom built up by expanded bank credit, but without any, you know, corresponding expansion, or it would have to be, I guess, exactly the same expansion of productivity or whatever to make up for it, then I don't really understand why, if he brings up, you know, whether high wages after the bust comes, whether that's prolonging the depression, what's the logic there in that kind of disproving the cause of the bust in the first place? Or is there any logic there at all, or just really that lousy of a smear job?
In terms of the keeping wages high?
No, I mean, in terms of Krugman's argument that if Mises is saying that keeping wages high prolonged the depression, somehow, what's the somehow that means that an artificial boom wasn't the cause of the liquidation that's going on now in the first place?
Yeah, well, the basic logic of it is, of course, is that, you know, the high real wages were occurring as the market topped and then going forward in the depression. And usually you think of causes of effects, that the cause comes before the effect. So, you know, I think that's one of the logical fallacies of all other business cycle theories, basically, is that the Austrians rely on the cause occurring before the effect. So we show in several different ways that that it was the central bank policy before the stock market crash and before the Great Depression that caused male investments in the economy that couldn't be sustained. Mm-hmm. And the other theories of the business cycle are things that took place after the stock market crash and while we were already in the Great Depression. So Milton Friedman's explanation, for example, is that the Fed didn't increase the money supply fast enough. But he's putting the cause of the Great Depression in the early 1930s.
Well, now Bernanke is actually saying that he learned that lesson from Milton Friedman, that's what the Fed should have done once the crash, never mind the bubble before it, but once the crash came, that's what he should have done, and that Bernanke followed Friedman's advice, and he saved us from the Great Depression, too.
Yeah, right. Bernanke's take on Friedman is that Friedman says they didn't increase the money supply enough. Bernanke said that they failed to bail out the banks. And so Bernanke is all about bailing out the banks, not necessarily, you know, the money supply angle on it. But again, both of those are things that occurred after the Great Depression was already underway. And so, you know, Bernanke is claiming that his policies have worked. But we're 6 years into this economic mess, and, you know, you can point to a few good economic statistics, like the frontline unemployment rate, but underneath those statistics, you have a very weak economy, you have a very weak job market, you have declining labor participation rates, you have declining real incomes, you have declining median family incomes, all of the basic statistics of economic health in an economy are actually negative. And you've got a record number of people on food stamps. You've got a record number of people who've been statistically taken out of the job market because they haven't had a job in so long they no longer count as either unemployed or even as a member of the labor force. So it's really hard to say with a straight face that the economy has somehow recovered, and they've been at it for 6 years at least with all of their policy manipulations, you know, other than the stock market itself, which is a direct manipulation by the central bank. Everything else is weak.
These are all talking points for the regime. I mean, I hate to say it, and I know that that's not what you're saying, but what you say kind of rhymes with, sounds similar to, the kind of rhetoric we hear from Robert Reich and whatever, you know, pet MSNBC economists saying, oh, it's just terrible, this income disparity and the failure of real wages to keep up with inflation and to keep up with the times and to keep up with productivity. And somehow this is still all a prescription for we need more of what the Democrats are giving us, because somehow the last 6 years, and the Republicans before that too, everybody knows I'm not partisan, but for the past 6 years, we've seen only the 0.1% get richer at the expense of everyone else. And so clearly we need the people who've been in charge for the last 6 years to do more of what they're doing so that it won't be like this anymore.
Yeah, and Robert Reich and MSNBC and CNBC and all the rest, they want even more government intervention. They want even more public works spending. They want even more government deficits and easy monetary policy, Scott. And, you know, basically what got us into this problem in the first place was easy money and government borrowing on a massive scale. What the mainstream economists have offered up as a solution to the problem is even more easy money and even more government debt and bailouts, of course. That hasn't worked. What we're saying is don't add to these problems, reduce these problems, balance the budget, and go to a sound monetary policy rather than an easy monetary policy. Let the market work. Allow prices to adjust. And, of course, the most important price in the economy, as you could put it, is interest rates. And the central bank has been not just manipulating interest rates, but directly controlling them on a massive scale. And so you know, what the problem, the mainstream solution, and what Robert Reich and his ilk are recommending is just more government spending, more government borrowing, more public works, easy monetary policy, continuing deficits. You know, you can't have any austerity in government policy, according to their, and, you know, the Austrians have a completely different prescription, and it's a prescription that's worked over and over again. And when they don't listen to the Austrians, you get scenarios like the Great Depression.
Yeah.
This Great Recession.
Although, you know what makes us look bad, though, is when, you know, Rand Paul gets up there and takes a brave stand against unemployment benefits for people who've been thrown out of work by this government policy. But we don't hear a thing, not anymore, not really, about the banks. I mean, just think of how many unemployed people on the low end could be, you know, have their paid benefits while their, you know, so-called benefits, whatever, which they have been taxed to pay for in the first place, could be paid with the money that they would spend if they would just quit spending, you know, $70 or $80 billion a month buying bad debts from Citigroup or from JP Morgan Chase. And it seems like, especially libertarians, when everybody figures that we're all just a bunch of rich, greedy white guys or whatever, we ought to always be attacking the banks and aiming up at the richest people on welfare. The F-35 boondoggle for Lockheed, there's nothing but a welfare program for a bunch of golfers. And instead of attacking people who've been thrown out of work by a policy that, as we're discussing, is all the government's fault, not theirs.
Yeah, it's. I mean, I always take my aim directly at the top. The corporatocracy.
I'm sorry, I know you're not Rand Paul. I just like complaining about that guy.
Well, you know, it's really hard sticking your neck out in public on mainstream radio and saying, you know, yes, we've got to get rid of these unemployment benefits. It obviously hasn't worked. And, you know, there's basic economic insights here that says that eliminating unemployment benefits or keeping them to a well-defined period of time is the right thing to do. And recently, the state of North Carolina was basically forced to cutting its unemployment benefits because it simply didn't have the money to continue to pay them. Its fund had run out. Its government was in debt. They had to do something, and so they cut unemployment benefits. And what they've seen in the last 6 months, I guess it's 7 months now, is that the unemployment rate in North Carolina has fallen from 9% down to 7%. And there's a lot of reasons for that, but the big reason is that they've taken people off of unemployment benefits, and those people have found some job or another. They didn't find necessarily the job they were looking for, but they found some means of economic support. And I think we have to keep that in mind, is that instead of being a burden on the taxpayer and the productive economy, once we eliminate these unemployment benefits, is that people find jobs, they start adding to the economy, and they start moving the economy from a quagmire into a more productive, more efficient economic system, and everybody is ultimately better as a result. And so we've got to keep in mind the pragmatic reasons why unemployment benefits are a deterrent to finding a job. And, you know, if you can get on unemployment benefits for an unlimited period of time and you can pick up some work on the underground economy working for cash or barter, and you don't have to go into work every day, it's a pretty good deal, especially if you can't find your preferred job. And so taking away those benefits unburdens the taxpayer and gets people back in the workforce where they really need to be.
Yeah, no, I you know, completely understand the economics of that. And of course, I'm not for the government existing one more day. So how's it supposed to give a, you know, any kind of benefit to anybody? But it just seems like we really ought to start with the highest income people being kicked off the welfare rolls first. And since all of the highest income people on the planet are on America's welfare rolls, we ought to, you know, have a real good time making sure that they have to operate in the free market. And then, you know, we'll get around to everybody else, too. It seems more fair to me.
Yeah, I agree. And so, you know, when people say, well, I know what you're against, but where would you start? I said, well, I wouldn't start with food stamps, right? You wouldn't start with unemployment benefits. What you'd start with is the military-industrial complex, where, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars are being siphoned off from the productive economy and put into what's called national defense. But, you know, there's no way anybody is going to attack the United States. We've got a nuclear arsenal larger than all other nuclear arsenals combined. We could destroy the planet 31 times over. Our military budget is larger than all of the other military budgets combined, you know, and that doesn't include the big spy state where we've got 11 different agencies spending untold billions of dollars, where the employees are all making $100,000 to $200,000 to $300,000 a year spying on the American people. And when it comes time for us to know about terrorists and, you know, threats and stuff, despite spending all this money, they never catch anybody. It's always some average private citizen who ends up catching this bomber or this killer or that murderer. And so it's easy to cut huge swaths of the corporatocracy government. And it all starts at the top. It all starts in Washington, D.C., New York City, and all of those corporations, which feed off the taxpayer for almost their entire budgets. And that, so I agree entirely. You know, that's where we want to slam on the brake, get out the knife, and get to work.
Yeah. All right, now, on the bubble, I don't know if we can really cover two bubbles at the very same time like this or not, but it sort of seemed fun to me to, well, I guess back when I was in high school and I first really read about the bubble of the late 20s leading up to the crash and how it was, and I think Bob Higgs writes about this in Depression, War, and Cold War, how it was Benjamin Strong, the chair of the New York Fed, who basically the chair of the Open Market Committee of the day, he was the one in charge of all Federal Reserve policy, basically. And he had a policy of inflating the dollar in order to help prop up the British pound, which was having an inflationary crisis because of all of their war spending on all their imperialism in Africa and that kind of thing. And yet the head of the Bank of England was a guy named Montague Norman, and he was the mentor, basically, for Benjamin Strong. And so Strong did him this favor by really pumping up the money supply. And I guess Rothbard writes in America's Great Depression that they had been inflating all through the 20s, and even though there wasn't much widespread price inflation because the increases in productivity at the same time were kind of disguising it, but the distortions and the malinvestments were really still there, disguised beneath the surface. But then 27 to 29, they blow up this giant bubble, which then pops. And to me, like when I first learned this for the first time, it's such the opposite of the way they teach the story in, you know, seventh grade social studies that, yeah, well, they used to have a free economy and it completely blew up in the late 20s and 30s. So we had to have this mixed quasi free market FDR New Deal to save the economy to rein in the excesses of the wild free market when the whole damn thing was engineered by the government central bank in the first place. So it's important for me to hear people or to see people, give people a chance to pick up on that for the first time if they've never heard that before, if they're only you know, hit to the government story about the free market of the 20s and all that. But then the real corollary I was trying to make here is with the bubble that crashed in 08, and I forget if we've spoken about this before, but there's this movie that's narrated by Matt Damon, the Democrat, called Inside Job, and that's not an actual truth or reference. It's a reference to just like a bank robbery, an inside job bank robbery, like where that phrase originally comes from. And so anyway, the whole thing, I don't know if you've seen it or not, but I would guess that Mark Thornton could give it like a 9.9 out of 10, this movie about these criminals on Wall Street and how they rigged all these derivative markets and everything. And yet, in the whole movie, there's this gigantic question that's left begging the whole time, that's left hanging the whole time, that they never ask, which is, where are the banks getting all this money from in the first place? What is a reserve ratio? What does it mean when the government when the Fed monetizes government debt and introduces new credit into the whatever, whatever? So they follow the money all the way to the second to last step. And it just seems like so many people are can be led so wrong by just that one almost small error of omission. You know what I mean? Where they still, even though we already have the whole narrative that free markets in the 20s didn't work, so we had the New Deal, and that was 70, 80 years ago. But now, for some reason, we're supposed to believe that the George W. Bush years was the Ron Paul years of a laissez-faire free market economy, a libertarian economy, rather than a conservative, crony Federal Reserve one. And so now, you know, I guess whatever the Democrats can do to control the economy, results notwithstanding, we've got to let them try because of how dangerous the free market is. And I follow these left-wingers on Twitter, and I see their conventional wisdom all day long about the end of capitalism, which has done this to us, you know?
Oh, yeah, and I haven't seen that movie, but it requires a Federal Reserve an easy monetary policy with guaranteed bailouts. Otherwise, these people wouldn't take on these risks if they knew they weren't going to get bailed out. If they were using their own capital rather than free capital provided by the central banks, they'd never, ever engage in this kind of behavior. And so if you look at the movies, The Wolf on Wall Street, that's a situation where a firm is in a regulated market, supposedly by the government, but it's skirting all those regulations very easily. And, you know, the same is true with the Great Gatsby. He's got all of this tons of money, and the reason he's got it is because he's got easy access to selling liquor during Prohibition. So it's always, you know, you've got to have the government in order to create these crazy, ludicrous, incredibly risky scenarios. Otherwise, it just wouldn't take place. It's the government bailouts and it's the government subsidies that always generate these kind of crazy, off-the-wall type of scenarios that we're living through right now. And you know, they're back at it. They're back re-leveraging the financial markets on a massive scale. So,
hey, unless that sound like an apology for the bankers, it was the bankers who created this government agency, the Federal Reserve, in the first place, just so they could screw us in this very fashion. So it's not like we're here as their defense lawyers here by blaming the government. It is a fascist combine between Wall Street and Washington, D.C., correct?
Yeah, it's the classic public-private partnership. It's the classic capital cronyism. It's, you know, and the banks, you know, the banks are the ones that induced the government to put this system together. And, you know, they tentatively have ownership. They tentatively have minor voting rights. But, you know, basically, especially with Bernanke in control, the central bank, the Federal Reserve, has been acting in the interests of the largest banks and financial firms in the United States, and against the interest of the average American who has seen no relief, has seen no way out of the quagmire that this whole system has created.
All right, everybody. That is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute. And let me tell you, at the Mises Institute, they got, Mark, what would you guess, 100,000 pages of economic writings that people can look at in every kind of format, or what?
Oh, a lot more than that. I mean, it's millions of pages, and, you know, you go to Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org, and you have the access to everything in economics about liberty, about history. It's almost all there available for sale or for free. And there's audio, video, written materials. There's daily articles, and there's journal articles, and there's huge economic tomes that cover all of economics. And so, you know, it's all there for the taking. Please come and visit us. Look at our events. We've got the great Austrian Economic Research Conference coming up with Judge Napolitano and James Grant. It's going to be wonderful. And I encourage everybody to come.
And where's that?
That's going to be here in Auburn, Alabama, in March. Judge Napolitano is going to be here, James Grant from Wall Street, the Austrian Wall Streeter, and all of the leading Austrian economists are going to be here. And it's open to the general public, and it's just a great event. It's one of my favorite events, and this year is going to be more special than any of the years in the past.
Okay, great. Well, maybe I'll see you there if I'm lucky.
Excellent, Scott.
Thanks very much for your time, as always, Mark. Appreciate it.
You're welcome. See you soon.
All right, everybody, that is Mark Thornton from the Ludwig von Mises Institute at Mises.org, M-I-S-E-S.org. And in fact, you can read a piece by Joe Salerno responding to Paul Krugman there if you want as well. Paul Krugman attacks Ludwig von Mises. That's a good one. Yeah, and this is Gangrene, and we'll be right back on the Scott Horton Show here in Q. Alright, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Let me get some anti-war stuff done for you here. First of all, there's this story in the New York Times last Sunday, the franchising of Al-Qaeda. And this is notable for a few reasons. First of all, because it's sort of kind of true that, man, this Sunni jihadism is spread all over the place. It ain't so centrally controlled. And it's problematic from certain points of view anyway. Could be problematic in the future for America. But it's also notable because this thing's like 7 or 8 years overdue. 9, 10 years overdue. 9 years at least. Come on. We've been talking about the decentralization. Let's see, it was the end of 2004 was when Zarqawi declared his loyalty to Osama bin Laden and his goals. So it was really almost 2 years into the war. So, 9 years. But, you know, Loretta Napoleone, the great Italian journalist, financial journalist, she wrote a book called Al-Zarqawi and the New Generation. That was the subhead. I forget the exact title. Let's see, she wrote Terror, Inc., but that was separate. Then there was another one. I forgot the main title of it, but it was Al-Zarqawi and the New Generation. And it was about the franchising out of Al-Qaeda. This is what, 2006, guys? 2007. That, you know, Al-Qaeda is just a word. And, well, let's see. If you want to change it from a group of 200 men, a bunch of lousy pirates banished to the ass end of the world, into a global movement, invade Iraq and stay there for 10 years. Yeah, that'll get it done for you. And, well, 8 years. So what happened is now they're, I don't know, at least, I don't know, Giraldi is always pointing out, it's still no more than a couple of few thousand of these guys, really, anywhere in the world, but still, Al-Qaeda in Yemen was nothing but a house full of guys back in 2001. Now it's a movement. And the more our government bombs them, the more of them there are. Huh. Staying in Iraq, turn the entire Sunni Arab part of the country, which no longer includes the capital city, but all the north and the west of the country, you know, less Kurdish territory. I mean, it's still the Iraqi tribes rule there, but they haven't stamped out Al-Qaeda or anything like that. Those guys have just been biding their time there. Thousands of men went to go and train and fight with them over the years, you know, did tours of duty, so to speak. Saudis and Yemenis and Libyans, Jordanians and Syrians and others who went to Iraq to fight. Then, of course, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group and Ansar al-Sharia and all these guys, Iraq war veterans, went home to Libya, convinced Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama to fight a war for them against the wacky colonel, the secular commie, Gaddafi. He wasn't really a commie. I mean, a commie would not consider him a commie, but any of us would. I mean, he was a secularist, as horrible as he was, and he was a really horrible dictator. His one virtue was he was good at keeping Al-Qaeda down, so America fought a war for the Mujahideen there. And then, of course, in Syria now, God, it's hard to believe. We've been backing the U.S. government, the CIA and the Saudis and the Qataris. They've been backing revolution, jihadi revolution in Syria for almost 3-4 years now, 2.5 years at least, since the dawn of the Arab Spring protests and the clamp down there in Syria, which they decided to try to hijack. And then now I got to read in the Sunday Review in the New York Times that, hey, guess what, guys? There are ruthless killers from Morocco to the Philippines calling themselves Al-Qaeda guys. And, you know, in many cases, yeah, cutting people's heads off and doing suicide attacks and waging, you know, radical Salafist revolution. Bin Ladenite foreign policy. Small private militias in stateless zones across the you know, the Middle East, Arabia, the Levant, and North Africa, and into Central Asia, and whatever. And all America keeps doing is making it worse. I'm sorry, I sound so jerky about this, just because I've been right about this since 2001. And it's amazing to me that people, in good faith, they really do, in good faith, they pursue these just completely ridiculous policies. And they just continue to make it worse and worse. In fact, I'll give you a quick example of that. I want to talk about Syria there, but let me skip to Afghanistan here, because here's Paul Pillar, former CIA analyst. In fact, he signed off on the bogus NIE against Iraq in 02. But anyway, he writes for the National Interest, and he's pretty right-wing. He hates Edward Snowden, the hero, for example. But here he's saying, how much is a drone base worth? And he's talking about how America's got drone bases in Afghanistan. It's part of the war there. And we've been using them against targets in the federally administered tribal areas of northwestern Pakistan for a while now. But so now, instead of these things are helping us fight our war, these drone bases are becoming the reason for the war, and that maybe we need to keep the war going just so that we can keep the drone base there. And he's saying, okay, maybe. Seriously, this is the argument he's making. You read it. How much is a drone base worth at the National Interest? He's saying, okay, maybe it's worth it, but we should at least examine whether it's worth it or not. Because what's happened here is that the priorities have switched from having a base as part of a war to having a war in order to have a base. And nobody is questioning anymore whether it's worth it or not. Whether using a drone to kill people in Pakistan, if it ever was, certainly efficacious for getting rid of the top 10 really, really bad guys there. Well, what about the bottom 10? Is it still worth creating more enemies, accidentally killing more tribal elders, and creating new enemies in their place to wage a drone war forever? Is there a point where we ought to ask ourselves if whether maybe we don't need a war so that we can have a base, so that we can use drones, so that we can kill people? Because maybe it's all counterproductive at this point. And Paul Pillar's point, the subtext here is that in good faith, the people in charge are that stupid and horrible and wrong and will kill people for ridiculous institutional plodding along. Well, we got this drone base. What are we supposed to do? Not drone people with it? And so they drone people with it. And then if they have to build a new policy around keeping the damn base, they will. Read it yourself. Paul Pillar, he's the former chair. I think he was the chair. He certainly was on the National Intelligence Council, which is the leaders of all the different intelligence agencies when they come together to tell us lies about stuff, usually, sometimes true stuff. But in the case of the Iraq war, this is the guy saying, yeah, we judge with high confidence Saddam has chemical weapons. Although I admit, though, that he did admit that, but he would never use them unless we attack first. That was right there in the NIE, but anyway. So there you go. In good faith, you can actually have policies so stupid. You know what? I brought this one up over and over again, too. Because it bothers me. It's like an itch I gotta scratch. David Gregory on Meet the Press says to Leon Panetta, at that time head of the CIA, geez, Leon Panetta, typically I would avoid a question like this, but god dang, there's reports everywhere that say that we are turning Al-Qaeda into a thing in Yemen by droning them. That every time we drone them, we make more enemies than we kill. So even to David Gregory, this doesn't quite sound like a good way to achieve an end of having less terrorists. Right? Well, gee, we can keep adding a net plus of terrorists, so, huh. And Panetta told David Gregory, in language that David Gregory could understand, hey, look, David, these are the tools we have. So if there's a guy down there that our guys have judged is a guy that we gotta kill, we gotta kill him. What do you want us to do? Not kill him? We gotta. Then they bomb a wedding and recruit 50 new people to join up Al-Qaeda that never had anything to do with it before. And go back and read the history of the drone war in Yemen, because it's been well reported in a lot of places. No, in very few places, it's been very well reported. And you can read about how, man, they killed a guy who was like the tribal chief who was, at the meeting telling Al-Qaeda they better never show their face around his guys again or whatever. Right? Or like, what was the one story? This is in Scahill's book. The elder told them, beat it. And then the U.S. killed the elder. So there was no one around to tell the Al-Qaeda guys to beat it anymore. So, and then everybody was pissed off that the elder guy got killed, and so they all joined up with the Al-Qaeda guys that the elder guy was trying to chase off. Anyway, it's typical. And they bomb weddings. I know, you know, the wedding of some brown guy you've never met, who's burning flesh you can't smell, who's, you know, back when he was alive, he spoke a language you couldn't understand, and so screw him, right? He's a cartoon character, right? Except that, man... Actually, no, they were real humans in a real wedding over there that got bombed. And man, if somebody bombed a wedding around here, that would be a really big deal, don't you think? Somebody bombed a wedding. On their wedding day. Bombed. Could you imagine that? Especially if it was a foreign government with a robot in the sky, what did it? Are you kidding me? Americans would be suicide bombing Pakistan in a day if that's what they had to resort to strike back. They would. If that really happened, we'd probably nuke them off the face of the earth. They used a drone against one of our Yemen. Pakistan, Yemen, I'm mixing my metaphors. You know what I mean. Anyway, so yeah, in good faith, people support this ridiculously counterproductive policy of making more terrorists with every attack. And that's ever since 1990. That's ever since occupying the Arabian Peninsula, bombing, waging aggressive war against Iraq. It really was aggressive war. Come on, they baited Saddam into invading Kuwait in the first place. And they bombed the hell out of him, killed tens of thousands of people, then occupied Saudi Arabia and stayed in order to enforce a blockade that killed another 500,000 people. Hundreds of thousands of people, of course, most of them children. The UN guys in charge of implementing the sanctions were resigning over, going, man, I can't stand killing kids no more. I'm going to go get a real job. I'm out of here. Remember Dennis Halliday? They killed hundreds of thousands of people with that blockade. And then, of course, all the no-fly zone bombing all the time and endless support for Israel and all their aggression against the Palestinians and the Lebanese. And that's what brought on the terrorist attacks of 2001. Actually, that's what brought on the terrorist attacks of 1993 and 1996 twice, and 98 and 2000, the cold air in 2000. The Al-Qaeda war against America started. And then ever since 2001, oh, look, they started it. And then our government goes around doing nothing but creating more and more of those guys. Now, what's funny is James Clapper told the Senate Intelligence Committee yesterday that the Al-Nusra Front, which they're trying to call those guys the Islamic Front, not so bad Al-Qaeda. Maybe Clapper needs to go and have a briefing with John Kerry. They can get their story straight about how Al-Nusra ain't near as bad as ISIS. Remember that, we're all supposed to say? I mean, they did let David Enders go, but anyway. The Al-Nusra guys, James Clapper said Al-Nusra would like to target the United States. Now, I don't know that that's true, and maybe that's just, you know, another bogus casus belli for trying to intervene in Syria against our allies, the Mujahideen. I don't know. Could be. Why not stab them in the back? Stab them all in the back. But my question is, if the Al-Nusra Front is targeting the United States, why? And never even mind the fact that the U.S. has been arming and funding the Al-Nusra Front, at least indirectly, pretty much directly. Not very plausible, deniably. Has been backing for the last couple of years there in that war. Never even mind that fact. Just pretend America was still paying Assad to torture these guys for us or whatever. Still, why would they want to attack the U.S.? September 11th already worked. You know, it's just like Jeff Huber said right before he died, which it really bums me out that that guy's dead. You think about all the great articles he would have written. My God. Well, he was just a good guy anyway, writing or not. But anyway, Jeff Huber said Osama bin Laden dead and loving it. He said, nobody without an army of his own has ever moved so many troops at his own will before in the history of the world. This guy's going down in world history for being completely powerless and yet making the empire do exactly what he wanted it to do. Radicalize the whole Middle East, bankrupt the American empire, overthrow Saddam. Didn't quite get that regime change in Iran he was pushing for. America's been spreading bin Ladenism all over the world. In fact, if you look at bin Laden's goals before September 11th, the only one that hasn't been accomplished was him being made king of the Middle East, right? Was Al-Qaeda actually becoming the ones in charge. And I think they were prematurely upset to see the Arab Spring break out as a stand for freedom and democracy. They didn't want democracy. They wanted a, you know, revolutionary Islamist state and all this stuff. But all they had to do was be patient to see that America will cancel all the elections they don't like, and they'll turn all these things into wars. You know, Ayman al-Zawahiri here, he's got to be laughing his ass off over America's Egypt policy right now, for example, as the bombings there just get worse and worse. I don't know how tough of an insurgency can really be waged in Egypt. They don't have the right to bear arms there, nothing like that, not like in Iraq. So I don't know how bad of a fight they can really put up there, but it's getting worse and worse all the time. The fight against the Islamists in Egypt by the military dictatorship that canceled the elections and overthrew the Muslim Brotherhood, which those guys are Islamists, but they're more conservatives than revolutionary types. They got they're too old and they got too much money to be real revolutionaries. But anyway, so there you go. I mean, I guess this thing will just go on. I thought it was funny. Dianne Feinstein yesterday on the Intelligence Committee hearing, she said there were 8,000 terrorist attacks last year. That was, you know, she's trying to get us to support the NSA spying and all that by saying there were 8,000 terrorist attacks last year. And of course, she didn't mention that most of those were in Iraq, where America overthrew the secular fascist dictatorship and created a giant civil war and empowered the Shiite majority and gave them the capital city and no incentive whatsoever to cooperate or get along with or compromise with the Sunni Arabs whatsoever. And so they haven't been this whole time because the American war, there was a massive failure and the surge was a massive failure there. And the Anbar province is completely frozen out of all power, which is the reason they were fighting all along, like we were trying to tell you. When the power was lost to the majority, and the Al-Qaeda guys, first of all, the army and the police of the Shiite government have no real authority in the Anbar province because they won't integrate Anbar province into their country, their state. So they're not, the state isn't welcome there either, has no real power there whatsoever either. And so the tribal leaders don't have the ability to control the so-called Islamic State of Iraq suicide bomber crazies. The best they can do is compromise with them, send them off to Syria, where America's backing them. That would be the other 4,000 terrorist attacks she was referring to, right? Half Iraq, half Syria, where America is backing ISIS and backing al-Nusra. And the Islamic Front, wherever that came from, all of a sudden, brand new name for al-Nusra, al-Qaeda terrorists. Guys who, you know what, and it is just a franchise, it is just a brand name, and maybe they're wannabes, and maybe the U.S. really likes calling Mujahideen al-Qaeda too, if they, you know, if it's a group that's on the outs, maybe they want to exploit that. But then again, you kind of got to give them credit a little bit. If they say that they are sworn in allegiance to Ayman al-Zawahiri and the goals of al-Qaeda, then yeah, take them at their word. And that doesn't necessarily mean attack America. Like I said, September 11th already worked in getting America to do their bidding. I don't think bin Laden would ever dream. I mean, I guess Zawahiri, talk about laughing his ass off about American Egypt policy, just setting his guys up to look like the only non-hypocrites in the country. Just look at Egypt. He must be laughing his ass off. They put a thing out the other day, and you know what? I don't know. Maybe the CIA's already got Zawahiri, and they've got him saying all this stuff or something, but I guess not. And he was saying, it was so funny, his air, his live omission here, or his statement, the omission in it, he said, you know, all the different Mujahideen groups fighting the revolutionary jihad against the Assad dictatorship in Syria, they all have to stop their infighting and get along. He orders them, he commands them, I am Ayman al-Zawahiri, new leader, former number two, now leader of al-Qaeda, and I say, all you jihadis get along to fight against the evil Ba'athist government of Syria and its Iranian and Russian and Chinese backers. Now you notice who's missing from that list. That's right. The U.S. and Britain and NATO. The West, which is fighting for al-Zawahiri right now. He was polite enough not to say, thanks, USians, for the money and the guns. And it's funny, because the right-wingers, like the real, like, World Net Daily kooks, they like to think that this is all because Barack Obama is some kind of secret Muslim himself, right? That he's siding with the terrorists in Syria. But, of course, that's not what's going on here. Barack Obama's not a Black Panther. Barack Obama's a white guy. Barack Obama is a conservative, nationalist, imperialist, president. Right. So, it's not that he's loyal to the goals of Zawahiri. It's that he thinks that he's the one who's clever here. And using al-Qaeda's shock troops to, if not overthrow Bashar al-Assad, at least, you know, weaken his power. And I guess maybe he's right. That this is accomplishing a short-term American goal in weakening Assad. But why is that an American government goal? To weaken Assad, who, after all, again, George Bush paid to torture people to death for us back just a few years ago. Why is it in America's interest to weaken him relative to the power of the Islamic State of Iraq suicide bomber brigades? So, you know, I don't know. And then another thing from the Intelligence Committee thing last year is Clapper said 7,000 foreign fighters have gone to Syria. And that would mean people, I guess, from around the Arab world, but including Europeans and Chechens and whoever. So then, you know, according to the state, that's the next big threat, right? White, blonde-haired, blue-eyed Muslims who went and joined up with the ISIS while they were there fighting in the Syrian jihad. If the last chapter of the terror war was blowback from the 80s war for the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, and then the war against them in Afghanistan and Iraq after that, then what's going to be the blowback from this? I mean, they really are creating the... They're erasing the border between Syria and Iraq. The Westerners are, and their Saudi allies, they're erasing the border there and creating that Islamo-fascist caliphate that used to be a ridiculous joke. Oh, yeah, the Islamo-fascist caliphate that exists, what, in bin Laden's attic where he's hiding even from his wives up there? That's some caliphate you got there, pal. But, no, now America is helping to create it out of the Anbar province of Iraq and the predominantly Sunni rebel-held areas of Syria. And, you know, Juan Cole, I don't like agreeing with Juan Cole because he was for the war in Libya, which makes him beneath contempt as a human being. But he did have this article about how, you know what, going ahead and giving up on the future of Iraq and Syria and creating a new state there, balkanizing, redrawing borders and that kind of thing, these ideas are gaining currency in D.C., right? Not, hey, just hands off and let the locals work this stuff out the best they can, their balances of power the best they can. No, we got to go in there now, like Richard Holbrooke at Dayton with a big black magic marker, and go, oh yeah, now you live in Sunnistan, and you live in, you know, Syrian Kurdistan, and you live under, you know, Barzani-stan, and you live in the Islamo-fascist caliphate-istan. And all that does is it means that these people are on the wrong side of the line, and these people are the wrong on the other wrong side of the line. And a bunch of bloodletting as everybody is cleansed from the areas where they don't belong. And he sure is right about that. And you know, he sure is right to advocate a complete, hands-off position instead. But that's scary to me, you know, to think that these know nothing know-it-alls up there in the State Department, we could just and they just pull out a map and a marker and start making up crap, and then this becomes the future of the world, you know, the wars of the future of the world. And so meanwhile, Jeff Huber's got exactly right, you know. Bin Laden's corpse couldn't possibly be more pleased with how events have played out so far. And, you know, really, unless you had, I don't know, a miracle happen where some real, you know, I don't know, Denis Kucinich became the president or something, I don't think Ron Paul would take enough interest to try to negotiate it. You'd have to have somebody who really meant well to just try to negotiate some form of let's get along for the future between the Saudis and the Iranians and the different sides over there in the Middle East to prevent the worst kind of war from continuing to rage for decades into the future, I think. And because of America's invasion of Iraq and the handing of Baghdad over to the Shiite Arabs, it's the first time the Shiite Arabs have controlled a Arab capital city in 1,000 years. And it's the kind of thing that, from the Saudis' point of view, cannot stand. And yet, it's the Americans who made it that way. It's the Americans who did all the fighting and dying to make Baghdad a Shiite city. And it's beyond the capacity of the Saudi Mujahideen to take it back at this point. And yet, it's a status quo that I don't think they will tolerate unless somebody can come up with a real good reason why they ought to give up the idea that they want Baghdad back and forever. And boy, talk about, you know, setting up the world for failure, man. That's way past the point, that region anyway. Way past the point. All right, I'm over time. I gotta go. See you guys.